Welcome to Lumber Dandy and Friends, everybody. My name is Benjamin David, and I'm glad you're here because I got a story for you today. This is the third episode of the only serialized adventure fiction podcast to chronicle the life and times of the legendary Lumber Dandy and his larger-than-life companions. And today we're going to be picking back up with the continuation of how the Lumber Dandy got his famous lavender axe. So if you're just joining us, please go ahead and head back on over to episode one, and we'll catch up with you real soon. Now, as you may recall from the last chapter, we left Bo Feller in the Oregon woods with his new friend, Porter Paisley, the morning after Bo had bested a mean-eyed lumberjack named Melvin Makewind and won his silver axe in the shaving duel. Now, they had agreed to journey to Astoria together, but I bet we all know a thing or two about best-laid plans getting interrupted when life has something else in mind to throw our way. So with that, I hope you're getting cozy and comfortable, because we are going to go ahead and jump back into the story and get Bo one step closer to becoming, once and for all, the one and only Lumber Dandy. After the shaving contest, Beauregard Feller's beard and mustache had grown back overnight, as they always did. And he'd said goodbye to Melvin Makewind and his sleepy crew just after sunrise. Bo had been joined by his new traveling companion, Porter Paisley, the mysterious lumberjack with the green carnation-patterned scarf, and Bo had been walking 16 paces in front of him most of the morning. They'd started out walking right alongside one another, but after a couple hours of Bo bragging about this and boasting about that, Porter had subtly slowed his steps and let Bo take a lead so he could read his book behind Bo's back. Now, Bo didn't even notice, as Porter had suspected he wouldn't, and went right on cheerfully talking about all the great things he'd done and seen in his travels, and all the interesting people he was going to meet, and how lucky they'd be to have met him, and all the big dreams he was going to make come true one by one, until he either ran plumb out of dreams or somebody painted the sky with purple polka dots, which he had decided long ago that he would take as a personal sign that it was time for him to settle down. Porter didn't mind Bo having such a high opinion of himself, especially since he'd proven in the duel that he wasn't all talk. But Porter had never had much patience for men who can't seem to quit talking long enough to hear what the world around them has to say every so often. It took a while, but eventually, Bo did realize that he was indeed talking to himself. Now, Bo's experience of the world, as a person of above-average charisma, was that folks tended to hang on every word he said, and it irked him to find that this new friend seemed more interested in a book than Bo's soliloquy. A mischievous idea occurred to him, and he curled his mouth into a sly smile and crouched down like a rock, getting ready to trip the bookish banjo player. It'd be a good laugh, as well as a guarantee that Porter would start talking again, even if just to holler in frustration. But without lifting his eyes from the page he was reading, when Porter got to the crouching Bo, he lifted his scarf into the air where Bo could have sworn it took the shape of a kite. Porter glided over Bo effortlessly, landed just beyond him, wrapped the scarf, which had turned back to being just a scarf, around his neck, and kept right on walking. Bo was miffed that his little prank had failed, but he was impressed. There was plenty more to Porter than meets the eye. He suddenly seemed to Bo like one of those Byzantine puzzle boxes he'd seen in a St. Louis shop window, a treasure chest locked up and full of the kind of wisdom that might teach the person who figures out how to open it things about themselves they never knew they needed to learn. Bo was desperate to learn all of Porter's secrets, even more than he wanted to consult that tailor about the coat buttons he'd mentioned to Melvin. And boy, he was particularly curious about that green carnation scarf. He got up and hustled on down the path to catch up to Porter. Bo asked if Porter was a wizard. Porter chuckled that he wasn't. Bo asked Porter if he was playing a trick so he could trap him and rob him, because nobody could trap Bo Feller, and Porter had better not even get the idea to try, or he'd get whooped pretty good. Porter said no, he was no burglar, and with a long sigh, he asked, Didn't Bo realize that men of their sort had to stick together if they wanted to get anywhere in this life, so tediously dominated as it was by the many Melvin Maquins of the world? And Bo thought about that for a minute, knowing in his gut that it was right. It made him feel good, but also sad. And he didn't care for mixed emotions. That was more Lance Spurwell's game. So Bo asked, where had Porter gotten that green carnation-patterned scarf? And Porter stopped still. He turned and shot Bo a queer look, a smile caught halfway between a conspiratorial invitation and a dire warning. And Bo loved the shiver it sent down his spine. I could show you, Porter replied, but we'll have to make a detour and, well, you might never be the same after. For a man like Beauregard Feller, who needs almost as much spontaneity as he does water to survive, well, the word detour is just French for adventure. Porter shut his book, turned to face east, and kind of yodeled a few notes onto the breeze. Bo was about to giggle at that when the tinkling of a tiny bell called out to them from somewhere off in the woods. Porter Paisley looked over at his dumbfounded traveling companion, winked again, and then shot off like a jackrabbit toward the sound of that bell. Well, Bo chased Porter through those woods at breakneck speed for almost an hour, genuinely confused how Porter was managing to keep ahead of him, seeing as how he was the fastest man he'd ever met or ever would meet. But Bo was having a grand time, bobbing and weaving between silver-blue spruces and towering firs with an irrepressible grin plastered on his face. You see, the only thing that Bo liked more than talking about himself was tumbling headfirst into the unknown. Well, that and slow dancing with a soft-hearted gent at sunrise, but he was too busy tearing through the forest to think about that right now. Porter stopped abruptly next to a massive sequoia and gestured for Bo to hush. He pointed up into the tree's branches, and Bo squinted to see a little bell on a string hidden in the leaves about halfway up. Porter knocked three times on the trunk, and to Bo's amazement, a little bark door popped open to reveal a cubbyhole in the tree. Looking inside, Bo saw a brass tinderbox with an engraving on the top. The initials W and W were winding around a carnation that looked suspiciously like the ones on Porter's scarf. Now, Bo was so preoccupied looking at the tinderbox that he didn't even notice that Porter had removed his scarf and transformed it into a parachute behind him. Porter told Bo to pick up the box, which of course he did without looking back, and the moment he did, a trap door opened in the earth beneath him, and Bo Feller found himself falling like a sack of sweet potatoes till he crash-landed on an ornate Persian rug 20 feet underground. Disoriented in the dark, and thinking to himself, oh, it was a trap after all, Bo balled up his freshly manicured fists and put his dukes up just in case. He wasn't scared. Not much in this world could make that happen, other than people using words like never and forever around him. But if there was going to be an ambush, he was ready to box him for bragging rights, or just directions to the exit. The sound of a match being struck in darkness, a brief whiff of sulfur. Bo's eyes adjusted to the dim light of a candle. He could just make out the shape of a strange hand lifting that candle to a trough on the wall about Bo's eye level. The trough must have been filled with oil or kerosene because the candle flame spread and illuminated to Bo that the carpet upon which he stood was a runner lining a long, elegant hallway. Curious, Bo thought. But it was nothing compared to the curiosity he saw next. The hand that had lit the candle was not a hand at all. It was a paw. A large paw with bony claw fingers that belonged to... Was he hallucinating? A hedgehog the size of a well-fed bear cub, dressed smartly in a burgundy velvet tuxedo jacket, with a pair of charcoal trousers and sporting a silk bow tie with a matching pocket square featuring the same green carnation pattern as Porter's scarf. All my goodness belongs to you, said the hedgehog, clearly waiting for a response. Bo was puzzled and for once in his life said nothing, which seemed to frustrate the hedgehog, who cleared his throat and said again, as if trying to indicate he was speaking in code, All my goodness belongs to you. Bo was at a loss and staring in confused delight at this strange creature in front of him, who was nonchalantly moving toward an alarm button on the wall just in case. He asked Bo again, not entirely without condescension, if he'd come to call on the Warm Brothers, sir, and might you be so courteous as to inform me of your name and title and whether you've made an appointment in advance? Well, Bo was, again, still confused, but at that moment, Porter Paisley gracefully touched down on the soft rug, having floated down through the trapdoor under the comfort of his parachute, which now he shook out and turned back into a scarf, which curled up around the neck for a much-deserved nap. All my goodness belongs to you, Porter yawned to the hedgehog, who then replied to complete the code, and all your hopes are my happiness. They then performed a secret handshake, the detailed maneuvers of which I am sworn never to reveal. There now, Higby, protocol taken care of, all safe and sound, Porter said, and the hedgehog sighed with the alluringly gentle disdain perfected by the world's most disciplined soldiers and glorious butlers, which Higby absolutely was. They're expecting me, Porter continued, and Higby led the men down the hall, inquiring about the seemingly mute, bearded ruffian Porter had brought with him, and didn't Porter know very well the rules about strangers, and the next time he popped by, would he be so kind as to inform in advance if he was bringing guests so that Higby could lay out proper portions for the tea service, or, forgive me, had all manners and decorum departed this terrestrial realm? And anyway, wasn't Porter supposed to be on a reconnaissance mission surveilling the Melvin Maquind operation? The hedgehog talked on and on and on, while Porter rolled his eyes to Bo as if to say, don't mind Higby. And soon the long hallway opened up into a spacious but cozy room, the center of which stood a large and inviting fire pit, surrounded by floor pillows on one side and chaise lounges on the other, all of which were embroidered with green carnations. The bohemian minimalism of the pillows stood in sharp contrast with the Victorian luxury of the chaise lounges. It occurred to Bo that this room had two distinct sides, like a brain, clashing but complementary, and he wondered if, like a brain, this room would produce its best when those sides found common ground amongst their differences. Either way, Bo was thrilled by this place. Porter had many secrets indeed. On one of the floor pillows sat an old man whose body was the reason for the word sinewy. A thick gray beard stretched from his chin to his navel, and he seemed content that the beard provided a home for three small birds and a family of chipmunks. His eyes were closed, and his meditative expression exuded tranquility. Now, opposite him was a man who seemed about halfway between Bo's and the old man's ages. He was impeccably dressed and coiffed, as if he were about to attend a performance at the Royal Opera in London, rather than scribbling furiously onto a scroll in an underground lair on the western edge of America. He was laughing to himself, fully absorbed in his own writing, evidently finding it to be quite amusing. Bo was drooling over the man's exquisitely tasteful outfit, admiring it from the fur-padded shoulders of the velveteen topcoat all the way down to the perfectly burnished cap-toe riding boots that Bo noted looked just about his size. Porter had already started crossing the room to pour himself a cup of coffee when Higby cleared his throat and announced, solely for Bo's benefit, the offices of the esteemed Warm Brothers, Misters Willoughby Whitmore and Oswald Wildebury. Whitmore opened his eyes and got up from his pillow with an agility Bo had not been expecting from a man so old. In a swift motion that almost seemed like teleportation, the older man was standing not 3 inches in front of Bo. His eyes were the same gray as his beard, and he stared into Bo and then pressed his forehead against Bo's. Neither said a word. They were translating to each other what their souls might have to say. Porter and Higby waited. This was a test that each new visitor had to undergo. A moment later, the elder man embraced the younger and whispered a single word in his ear. Bo was amazed. He hadn't been sick, and yet he still felt somehow as if he was now healed when Whitmore let go and sat back down on the pillow. Wildeberry, for his part, didn't go in for all that sentimental spiritual rot, yet he couldn't deny that Whitmore's assessment of new visitors had never failed to separate the worthy from the not. And apparently this large rascal with a aspirational at best fashion sense had been deemed worthy. They finished up their introductions, with Higby trying to maintain some sense of pomp and circumstance while Porter was talking over him to get to the heart of the matter. Bo was one of them, and Porter had brought him to the W's for initiation. Wildeberry told Higby to prepare the room for a salon, and the hedgehog dutifully complied. Bo got excited because he thought he'd lucked out and the W's were going to provide him with that barber he'd been looking for after all. But he got confused when he saw Porter tuning his banjo and Higby laying out little slices of cornbread with rosemary garnish on dainty doilies and teacups on a silver tray. Whitmore explained that all new recruits to the ranks of the Fraternal Order of Warm Brothers had to share a piece of their truest selves in the salon circle. Bo was confused. "A talent," called Wildeberry. "A talent. You must reveal to us at least a flash of the creative spark that lives within. The type or quality of your offering matters not. What matters is that you make it. My dear companion Willoughby looked into your soul and determined that its shape was kindred to ours, and I will take his word for it. So now we want to see you express the spectrum of its colors. Share them with us, as we will share ours with you, and you may count yourself one of us the rest of your days." Well, fiercely independent as Bo was, he wasn't certain he wanted to get conscripted into any sort of group, even one that excited him like this one and seemed suited for a man like him. But then, old Whitmore's voice whispered again, but from inside his head, the same single word as before. Bo once again felt that strange sensation of healing, or of being cured of an ailment he hadn't known had afflicted him. It would be months before he realized what it really was, his first taste of true belonging. Bo looked over. Whitmore was staring at him through closed eyelids, and such a luminous peace shone out of the old man that Bo decided he was plenty ready for his first salon and might even ask to stay for his second. Porter volunteered to go first. He sang a ballad, plucking his banjo, about a young man who'd fallen into a river and been saved by a girl with a giant left arm, who asked him to marry her and carried him off in the crook of that arm to her lonely home behind a waterfall. The song was haunting and odd and funny, much like its singer. Mr. Wildeberry went next. He started to read the first scene of the play that he'd been working on when Bo had arrived, but soon he got bored with himself and instead decided to improvise a comedic oration of astonishing wit on the question of whether it is better for a man like himself to aspire to infamy or to notoriety. He eventually concluded, to the laughter of his listeners, that the point was moot, for as long as other people were using their precious time on this earth to gossip about him behind his back while he pursued a life of his own magnificent curation, well, then he was pleased as punch and spirit-rich and both infamous and notorious after all. Whitmore revealed himself a poet and spoke aloud one of his finest works from memory. The words spoke of nature and of stars and of the all-too-frequently syncopated rhythm of hearts beaten in and out of time with one another as they spend this life searching, searching, searching. Whitmore was only halfway through the poem when all present noticed that Bo had begun growing again, just like he had during the shaving duel. The poem had stirred something so deep in his soul. It had lit the piece of his pride that desires to do good for others, and his body swelled 2 feet taller and 3 shoe sizes outward. Whitmore continued his poem, and Bo continued his growing. The poised Mr. Oswald Wildeberry's jaw went slack at the sight. It was an odd pose he would later deny ever having adopted, and Porter gave him a look like, "See, I told you this one was special." Luckily, Whitmore finished reading, reciting, just at the moment Higby was becoming quite worried that Bo would grow so tall he'd burst the seams of the room. Well, I think we've seen enough talent out of you for one salon, Wildeberry said as Bo shrunk back down to his typical size. The W's leaned in close together and whispered for a moment, and then they announced they felt certain that Bo Feller was the one destined to hold the Lavender Axe. Well, there was some disagreement between them about whether such a thing as destiny exists or if Bo's power in the existence of the fabled Lavender Axe handle was simply a happy coincidence of cosmic chaos, but nevertheless, Bo was decided to be the one to wield the axe. Bo liked the idea and imagined how the elegant silver steel axe head he'd won off of Melvin would look fixed atop what he imagined would be a beautiful pastel shade of lavender handle. He said he'd love to have it, and the W's told him, well, that was lovely, but they didn't know where it was. He'd have to journey to the cave of Grey Damien, the Oracle of Oregon, and ask him to divine its location. To gain entry to Grey Damien's cave, however, Bo would need to bring a pink narcissus, the Oracle's favorite flower in all the world. Bo asked where he could find one, and Wildeberry replied they had one in stock, but Bo would need to trade him Melvin's silver axe if he wanted to take that flower. And Bo would also need to pledge that he would heed the call if the Warm Brothers ever needed him to fight on their side in the future. All of this made Bo a bit uneasy, but he heard Whitmore's word ringing out inside his head again, and he felt okay. And honestly, he really wanted to find that lavender axe handle. He loved pretty objects, sort of like a raccoon that way. So he agreed, and celebrations were in order. Whitmore initiated a fantastic ceremony to finish up the induction of Bo into their ranks. Again, these secret rites and rituals I have sworn never to reveal further. Now, Bo was looking forward to a night sleeping indoors by the warmth of a fire pit on a comfortable sofa, but he was instead quickly ushered to the back door of the W's offices, having been told there was no time to delay in beginning the trek to Grey Damien's cave. Higby knew the way and agreed to take Bo as far as the moonlit marsh. So the W's hitched a chariot to the hedgehog's back, and Bo was invited to ride. He said he could walk just fine on his own, but Higby demanded he ride that chariot because he was still under the Warm Brothers' hospitality, and besides, a hedgehog needs his exercise. Bo bid farewell to the W's and looked around to see that Porter had already disappeared. Before he could wonder when next they'd meet, Higby was off and running, pulling the soon-to-be lumber dandy through the crisp midnight air. And that's where we'll leave Bo for today. We'll pick up here next week for the next chapter of how the lumber dandy got his famous lavender axe. This chapter makes me think a lot about people of different ages finding connection with each other and how building yourself an intergenerational community of friends and loved ones can give you a greater perspective on your own life and your place in our shared human history. I think about how much we can learn from the experiences of those who are much older or much younger than we are, and how having a sense of history can bring hope and joy to our hearts as we look toward a brighter future. So I just wanted to read one of my favorite statements from one of my heroes, Walt Whitman, who I consider a personal ancestor, and I'd like to think he'd be okay with that. Whitman once left this passage for us, and it's one of the blueprints for living that I return to read every few weeks when I need a lift and a reminder of what really matters to me. So I hope it gives you something to hold on to as well. He wrote, "This is what you shall do. Love the earth and sun and the animals. Despise riches. Give alms to everyone that asks. Stand up for the stupid and crazy. Devote your income and labor to others. Hate tyrants. Argue not concerning God. Have patience and indulgence toward the people. Take off your hat to nothing known or unknown, or to any man or number of men. Go freely with powerful, uneducated persons, and with the young, and with the mothers of families. Read these leaves in the open air every season of every year of your life. Re-examine all you have been told at school or church or in any book. Dismiss whatever insults your own soul, and your very flesh shall be a great poem, and have the richest fluency not only in its words, but in the silent lines of its lips and face, and between the lashes of your eyes, and in every motion and joint of your body. Now, what can I say to follow that? Nothing, right? Have a wonderful week. Be good to yourself and to those around you, whether you can see their burdens or not. And I'll meet you here next week with the next chapter of Beau's story, when he attempts to cross the treacherous moonlit marsh and has a showdown with the mysterious Grey Damien. I'll see you soon. Thanks for listening. And tell your friends if you think they'd like to be a part of our crew, and most of all, celebrate the beauty and the wonderment that is you this week, just as you are.